Session number 11105, Colonel M. McBain, Reel 7.
Colonel M. McBain, Reel 7. What was the role of the battalion in Berlin at this time, Colonel?
The battalion was part of the Berlin Infantry Brigade, which consisted of three infantry battalions and an armoured squadron. There were no guns. And the role must have been to defend our bit of West Berlin against the Russians. We didn't appear, from memory, we didn't do any active rehearsal or practice or anything, drills for this manoeuvre or operation of war. I mean, I can't remember going off to be told, this is where you go to, McBain, or I honestly can't remember. And so that was the brigade. There was a brigade headquarters under the British Berlin headquarters, which had a major general, and that he was there as a political appointment, because each of the occupying powers had a major general or equivalent, it was the brigade with its brigadier and normal brigade staff. And the headquarters is, both headquarters were in what had been the Olympic Stadium. The Berlin Olympic Stadium was in the middle of our sector. And they, in fact, effectively were our sports field. So we were very lucky we had all the facilities of the Olympic Stadium. Running tracks, pitches, swimming pool, boxing arena, the whole lot. And, as I say, the brigade headquarters and British Troops Berlin, BTB as it was called, they were there. The Berlin sign that we wore on our battle dresses was a red circle, a black patch with a red circle on it. The two other battalions, when we were there with the Black Watch and the Kings, Liverpool, and a squadron of the Third Hussars with Centurions. There were sappers, ordnance, RASC, transport, fairly hefty military police presence. And a fairly large, or it appeared to be large, fortunately I was never in there, military hospital.
So, on any given time, did you have to go out to some spot or area for your day's work, in effect?
No, we were normally in barracks or out training, normal infantry training, in places like the Grunewald. There were very good ranges. The ranges were ex-German army ranger Ruhleben. It is extraordinary how names come back to me. I mean, I haven't thought of Ruhleben for 20-odd years, but Ruhleben ranges, which by British standards were very, very good rifle ranges. But in fact, Ruhleben was famous as being the home of the pre-war German film industry. Had been at Ruhleben, and the studios, some of them, what was left of them, were still there. We did train on inner city street fighting, and of course there were a lot of places to practice that. One of the places had been German Army or German Air Force School of Engineering. It had obviously been a very, by 1930-40 standards, a pretty high-tech place. Big concrete buildings and so on, which was derelict. And so that was a very good place we could go and play street fighting in there. One of the roles was, in fact, internal security, just in case the citizens got a bit restless and got a bit chirty. And so we practiced the internal security drills, which the British Army had practiced ever since Amritsar in India. And in fact, after I got to Berlin, we were involved in a thing that went on every year. So if we stick to the battalion and rail, as I say, must have been to part of the brigade and defend certain bits of West Berlin. I was posted to B Company when I got to Berlin and posted to 5 Platoon. At that time, of course, all the company commanders and quite a number of the company second in command had been through the Second World War. They were all very experienced operators. Platoon commanders were all, you know, post-war generation.
Who was your company commander and second in command?
I was afraid you'd ask that. The company second in command, I do remember. Company commander. In fact, in my defence, he was literally only there for a couple of weeks. And then a man called David Fenner took over, who remained a very close friend for many, many years. And he and I got on extremely well together. David had been parachute regiment during the war, but was basically DLI. And he eventually took over B Company, and we became very good friends. The other platoon commanders, there was one other regular officer, myself and a national service officer, as the 3 platoon commanders. And we were in one of these barrack blocks. Platoon commanders had a room in one of the corridors where we used to go and sleep after the excesses of the previous night. No, and we obviously had our barrack rooms where the platoons lived. From memory, the platoons were reasonably up to strength. You know, muster parade, you probably had 20-odd soldiers, unless there was something odd going on somewhere. And again, from memory, I ran my own platoon training program. And within reason, I think we were allowed to do what we wanted to do, get on and do it. Obviously, there were company activities, and we'd go off into the Grunewald and do platoon or company things, normal infantry training. But then the first sort of big highlight was May Day in Germany. In fact, on the continent, it's a big day. Far more so than in this country. In Berlin, there was a great big rally in West Berlin in front of the Reichstag, or the ruins of the Reichstag, the shell that was left. And at the same time, there was an equally big rally going on the other side in the Russian sector, literally half a mile away or less. And the worry was, perhaps, that the local populace might take the law into their own hands and decide to have a go at one another. And so all the garrisons were sort of standing to over May the 1st. And the year we were there, we got the job of having to look after the immediate surroundings of the big crowd. I mean, we're talking about 500,000 people. It was a very big crowd in front of the Reichstag. And to do this, we deployed right before down to, from memory, the Bellevue Schloss, which had been a big royal palace at one stage, Prussian royal palace, The tale was that Goring had lived in it at one stage. It was now a ruin, it was derelict. But the whole battalion would hide in there because from there you could in fact see the big empty space in front of the Reichstag. And keep an eye, so you were ready to leap out and do whatever had to be done. And so, as I say, the night before we deployed down to there, and it was a normal military manoeuvre. But to my shame, I don't know, we all moved at different times, company groups going down during the night by transport. And I forget what time it was, but let's say it was 2 o'clock when B Company were to go off down the road. I had set an alarm clock, I had told my batman, and I told my mate in the next door room to wake me to make sure. Because it all failed. And so I, for some reason, woke up, I don't know what made me wake up, at 2:30. And so I panicked and rushed around and got across to the barrack block just as C Company were leaving. And so I leapt on a wagon and went down and got down there. And this was a very large ruined building, not far short of Buckingham Palace size. And so I was crashing around in the dark trying to find B Company. And of course, life being what it is, I literally bumped into the commanding officer, who was a great man.
What was his name, Colonel?
His name was Michael Hanmer, who had at one stage during the war commanded 60 LI and had finished as a brigadier, but had then come down to his substantive rank. He'd commanded 60 LI in the Battle of the Reichswald Forest. And he was a nice man, but a very stern man, and a very good commanding officer. As my first, one tended to use him as the benchmark, and there weren't many overtook him. So there we were in the middle of this bombed out building, stumbling around. He had a torch, I didn't, and he said, McBain, looking after your soldiers. I mean, little did he realise that I had literally just arrived. So McBain missed his first deployment into battle by about 30 minutes. Anyway, I got down, and David Fenner, the company commander, was fast asleep in a bath. Because, there were baths and bathrooms and bits and pieces there. And quite sensibly, as the company commander, he had chosen the bath to sleep in. And so I reported. And again, it was very good. There was no unpleasantness or anything. And we spent that night, obviously, and the whole of the next day, which was May Day, in that building up on the roof watching this great crowd. It was interesting because a tremendous amount of propaganda and psychological business going on. The minute speeches started on our side, the East Germans or the Russians turned on loudspeakers and blasted music and shouting and so across. How the hell anyone heard anything? I don't know. In fact, there was no trouble, which says a lot, of course, for the West Berlin police and the East Berlin police, who had the same on the other side, almost within sight of one another, not quite. And they all just pushed off and went home, and we went home just after them. But that was the first, and in fact, the only time, really, we were involved with that sort of, that was a live situation. Just a mention of the West Berlin police. They, in fact, were a paramilitary organisation. They effectively were a brigade of the German army. And they had a role as such. But of course we didn't, nobody spoke about that. They were the West Berlin police. But they did have these companies and organisations to form the brigade.
Did you come into contact with any of the Russians?
No. No, we saw them, we could see them. I mean, they were, their war memorial was in our sector. And again, that was part of this 1st of May thing, because the crowd was sort of spilling around the Russian war memorial. And that was one of the jobs someone had to do, was to make sure that they didn't get over enthusiastic and start messing around with the Russians. You could see them, but there was no contact. There was, unbeknown to us, at a higher level, obviously, and I wasn't conscious of it, but it must have happened. I know that if the officers' mess had a cocktail party and invited Americans and French officers, you also, protocol said you had to invite Russians. Whether they came, of course, was entirely up to them. But I wasn't aware of them coming to the mess this time. Second time round in 68, I can remember them coming. And they used to drive around our sector. And of course, the main time you saw them was when they were on Jew Spandau, because each country took it in turns, a month line, to do the Spandau duty. And the Russians would tended to, it was a company task, and the Russian company tended to march around Spandau in the early hours of the morning singing Russian marching songs, just give them a bit of exercise, I think, because whereas the British guard would probably only be a platoon at a time, and they, you were in there and then went back to your own barracks. The Russians, of course, were from the other side of town. And they would put the whole company in there, and it really just gave them a bit of exercise, that was all. In fact, you know, Russian singing was pretty good, so you didn't worry too much. But they were obviously, they were there, and you could see them.
Did you do a Spandau guard?
I didn't personally, no. The company did, but I in fact, now that you mention it, I was, for some reason, because I was not a particularly good shot, I was all right, I was selected to go back to England to do a sniper's course at the School of Infantry in Hythe. Now then, at the time, we knew we were going to go to Korea, so it must have been sort of halfway through the tour. We did each battalion did a year in Berlin, and it must have been about halfway through, and I was detailed off to go on this course, and I think we knew by then that we were going to Korea. So off I went, and I think that's possibly when the company did the Spandau Guard. One of the things that one did was the officer commanding the train, ever since 1945, the French, Americans and British ran a train into Berlin and out each day, a military train, and there was a guard on that with an officer in charge. And in 1951, it went by night, and so it was a night you slept, in fact, from Berlin down to Helmstedt or Hanover. No, I think you actually went on to Hanover or Brunswick. Anyway, you went on the train overnight and you just slept. You had to get up at some stage, hand over train documents, and you had an interpreter with you, normally a British Army sergeant, staff sergeant. And they were interesting people. They were of Central European origin, most of them, Poles and Czechs, who spoke German fluently and spoke Russian fluently. Then you came back again the next night. So that was a break in the routine. And of course, in those days, that was the only way in and out of Berlin. other than road, and nobody went on the road. Battalions, individuals, families, and so on, all came in and out by train. There was no air trooping.
When you returned to the battalion at the sniper's course, what did you do then, Colonel?
I was detailed off to run a sniper's cadre, and in fact ran three sniper cadres. And that really was very good as a young second lieutenant.
What did that entail?
Well, training people, potential people, to join the battalion sniper section. The instruction at Hythe had been, as usual, a very high standard, and it was quite clear that actually to get your sniper's badge was pretty hard work, and if you qualified, you deserved it. And so it was a very exacting course with a bit of shooting, but, you know, snipers only fire one bullet a day, if that. Yes, you were on the range every day, but, you know, it was concealment, movement, camouflage, observation. It really was very good, and of course I was lucky. The companies nominated pretty high-grade soldiers. And so I was given carte blanche. I'd take them off into the Grunewald or wherever. And that was good. And then when I'd finished that, I can't remember. I mean, it was within a very short space or before we left Berlin, 2-3 months, we got a national service into the battalion from the depot at Brownsmith. And this was 30 or 40 people. And I was given the job of what was called continuation training. They'd done their recruit training at Brownsmith, but they now needed their continuation training and radios and things. And so I had these 35, 40 heroes, again with a good gang of NCOs to help me. And I enjoyed that. That was great. Again, I had almost carte blanche with the facilities. And at the end of it, I thought I'd take a chance. And the commanding officer was taking the passing out parade. Before that, I asked him, could I keep this lot as my platoon to go to Korea with? Because my existing 5 platoon, being basically national service, had started to dribble away and be demobilised. And, you know, it was really quite small. And so I asked commanding officer if I could keep this lot that I'd got to know and they'd got to know me as my platoon. There's 5 platoon. And bless him, he said yes. And so that was tremendous, because it meant I was going off to war with a bunch of soldiers that I'd trained, and we knew one another pretty well before we started. And I was very pleased about that.
They were good quality, these national servicemen, when you got
them. Well, yes, they were adaptable, and of course, it was in those days, infantry soldiering was still pretty basic, pretty simple. We didn't have great sophisticated radio nets or vehicles or weapons. So it was basic infantry soldiers. And yeah, they were pretty good by the time we'd finished our training. Together, they were pretty good. I mean, included in this training was a spell out of Berlin, down in West Germany, at a very good, very large army training area called Sennelager, which is still in use to this day. It had been a pre-war German army training centre. And each company went out to Sennelager for, I think, a fortnight before we left Berlin to come back to this country. Well, that just set the seal on me and my heroes, because we were firing live ammunition, and thinking about it now again, all slightly strange, and our company commander, David Fenner, had only been acting company commander. A man appeared to be our company commander called Hugh Oldman, who, again, nice man, I got on extremely well with him on and on throughout my time with the regiment. Hugh Oldman had, in fact, commanded the cadre of 8 Deer Line in 1945, and when 6 and 8 came back to England as a cadre before the end of the war, Hugh Oldman arrived, and we went down to Senilaga, Hugh Oldman company commander. Jervis Percy was by then the second in command, and we still had the same 3 platoon commanders. But Hugh Oldman wasn't coming to Korea, because we were about to reform the 2nd Battalion, and Hugh Oldman had been designated to go to the 2nd Battalion. And we hardly ever saw him. He was down there, I know, but he was living in a hotel somewhere with his wife had come with him. And we hardly ever saw him. And so we had the run, because we were going to Korea, we had the priority use of the Senilaga training areas, which were marvellous and very, very good. They're still the best infantry training area in the world. Unlimited ammunition. And really, we just got on with it. So that was a great climax to the training of what had now become my platoon.
You had a platoon. How was it made up?
Well, as platoon headquarters was, we were still very much a 1939-45 type organisation. It hadn't changed. Platoon commander, platoon sergeant, I had a batman and a radio operator and a medical orderly, and that was platoon headquarters. 3 sections, each with a corporal.
Do you recall any of the names of the people you had?
My platoon sergeant was, this is my senility coming back again. I can picture him, I can see him coming through that door. He was a very big man. He had been 8th Army heavyweight boxing champion, would you believe it? He was a Cockney too, which was unusual. Was it McCoy? Mick something. But he was great. We had this very good relationship, the traditional sort of the officer and his platoon sergeant, and he would tell me what to do, and then I'd do it. Section commanders, I can't remember. I can remember odd names, and in fact, I do see a number of them from time to time. Now, in Durham, we're all old men now, but they are still around, a number of them, obviously. And I do see them from time to time. Not, just in the street.
What weaponry did you have?
Again, very basic weapons. It's 10 guns. I was listening to that. We had 10 guns, number 4 SMLEs, 2-inch mortar, and 303 Bredens. Very pistol. And that was it. Picks and shovels.